House Judiciary to order right now, and it is Wednesday, February 11th, and we have present with us Representative Clayman, Representative Lynn, my Vice Chair, Representative Keller, Representative Grunberg, and Representative Foster. And I am Representative Ledoux, the Chair of the Committee. Everybody, before we begin, just a housekeeping matter. Please silence your electronic devices. And we have with us today Christy Blair, the House Secretary, and Alex Giudis, am I pronouncing that right, I hope, our moderator from the Legislative Information Office. And we have one bill previously heard today, that's HB 79, an act relating to controlled substances, etc. And we also have one new bill, and that's HB 5, an act relating to the persons who may be appointed conservators of a protected person. And we're going to start with the new bill before returning to the marijuana crime bill. And presenting on behalf of the sponsor, Representative Hawker, is Cecile Elliott. Ms. Elliott, could you please come forward, place yourself on the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Ledoux. Members of the committee, my name is Cecile Elliott. I'm staff to Representative Mike Hawker. House Bill 5 expands the definition of CAB conservator under 1326.210. Under current statute, certain criteria prohibits a person from being appointed conservator unless they are a relative. However, this list of relative is specific to spouse, adult child, parent, or sibling, thereby excluding other relatives. House Bill 5 expands the definition to an adult related by blood, marriage, or adoption. The sponsor feels that this offers the protected person a larger pool of family members to choose from, allowing for greater control in making decisions that are in the best interest of their family. This statutory limitation came to our attention through a constituent, Mr. Colby, whose desire to be conservator for his daughter-in-law was thwarted by current statute. I believe he is online to testify in support of the bill today. House Bill 5 does not change the judicial process for appointing a conservator or weaken the court's authority to act in the best interest of the protected person. I'm happy to answer any questions. This bill is also supported by the Alaska Commission on Aging, and I believe they are here today, too.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd like to apologize to everybody. But sometimes when I read something, things don't become apparent to me until they percolate. And that's what's happened here. And if I may, if I could ask Ms. Elliott, let me ask who else are going to be testifying. She may not be the right person to ask.
We have Darren Combrey, who was mentioned by Ms. Elliott. And we also have Terry Bannister from Legislative Legal, who might be the right person to be.
Is there anybody else in the audience or online who's here to answer a question? Because I have a very technical question.
I see somebody raising their hand back there.
Okay.
My name is Deb Etheridge, Deputy Director with Senior Disabilities.
Probably won't be you. Who else? This is taken from a Uniform Act.
Representative Grunberg, we have to have people up here before.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to figure out who I want to ask. My question relates to the fact that this is part of a Uniform Act, and we're making a change to a Uniform Act. And I'm wondering if there's any lawyer or anybody who knows about this Uniform Act. Let me tell you what my question is.
All right.
And it's a general. Mr. Jesse, you're here generally. Okay. Maybe somebody. This is from the Uniform Probate Code, which apparently, I'm not sure. This was enacted in 2012, so I'm not sure how much. Maybe I should ask Ms. Bannister this question.
That's fine. Do you have any other questions for Cecile right now?
Right now.
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions for Cecile? Representative Clayman.
Thank you. The proposal amendment is to remove the language, the spouse, adult child, parent, or sibling, and replace it with adult related by blood, marriage, or adoption. And I'm looking at the definition section, and I see no definition of those three terms And I didn't check, but I believe the other four terms that are being deleted are actually are defined. And is there a definition that is being incorporated in there? And if so, where are they, if you know?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, when I spoke to the drafter about the bill, we wanted to expand the definition to include all family, and this is what they advised. So I would defer to the drafter, Terry Bannister, who's online, to answer that question.
Mr. Bannister,
yes.
Or Ms. Bannister, sorry. You're online. Maybe
yes,
you can answer Mr. Representative Klayman's question and then Representative Grunberg's question.
I don't believe there are definitions at this time of the new terms.
First, with respect to marriage, which is a, I'm recognizing that in today's legal environment, the definition of marriage is something that is actually getting a tremendous amount of litigation in the courts. It's an issue that I believe is before the Supreme Court this term, and I'm wondering why you would elect to use the word marriage, an undefined term, although it has been defined by the voters in our Constitution, why you would be choosing just the term marriage for a statute like this, where, I mean, I think the goal is to try to expand the scope of people that are recognized as reasonable people to be considered as a conservator, but I'm not sure that this works for those purposes, for those very reasons.
Through the chair.
And Ms. Bannister, just for the record, I neglected to ask you to identify yourself for the record, so please do that.
I am Terry Bannister, and I work for Legislative Legal Services.
Thank you.
Through the chair, there have been at least two people working who have worked on this bill. I don't remember choosing those terms myself, so I don't remember why. However, and I would, you know, tend to know that they would be interpreted, have to be interpreted, each one. And there is an interpretation requirement, but if a person is married, then I would tend to interpret by marriage to be someone who's related through the person who is married.
One more follow through the chair. In the same query about what is adult related by blood also appears to be a term that has potential for a lot of ambiguity. And was there any thought given to trying to make a little bit more clarity in terms of that definition?
Through the chair, as I said, I don't recall, or I didn't do that actual particular item when it went through. It could certainly be clarified if you wanted to clarify it. We always recommend clarifying anything that's ambiguous.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to associate myself with those questions first, but that wasn't what I was going to ask. Ms. Bannister. I see this bill was enacted, enacted initially, and the members can look, if we have the text of the full statute, in 1972, and it's been amended a number of times since. When it was enacted in 72, I do believe it was part of the Uniform Probate Code, right?
Through the chair, I would assume that, but I would have to double check. I would assume that, though.
Okay. We have the Alaska text here, and I'm wondering if you or I, actually, if it's okay, ask Ms. Elliott or anybody, if anybody has looked at the Uniform Probate Code, the annotated version, to see how other courts have interpreted this subsection. Has anybody looked at the annotated code to find out the answer to that question?
Through the chair, I have not done that.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I am aware that that's a uniform from 1972, and then again, it was proposed 94, I believe, that we did not adopt recommendations of the Uniform Probate Code. I can't expound on your question, however.
Madam Chair, and the members who've been around know that we a lot of times look to uniform laws, and I think it's a good policy when we're going to amend a uniform law. We should look at the annotated uniform law and see how courts have interpreted this and probably give a call back to Ben or Zinke or somebody. Ben's the guy we've been working with last year on the Uniform Transfer on Death Act, and they've got some really good professors who've been working on this, and I'd like to see the answer to that because I don't know why they drafted this subsection the way they did. It would seem to me that there's no reason to limit it on subsection C to a spouse, adult, child, parent, or sibling. The only issue should be the court determines that the potential conflict of interest in B is not substantial, and it shouldn't make a difference who that person is as long as there's no conflict of interest. And then we don't get into the thorny issues that my friend from West Anchorage has raised and that could cause this to be litigated and stuff. We simply strike that language if it's okay under the Uniform Code. And I'm not trying to delay this or anything. I'm trying to make sure we don't litigate this. And a simple ledge research or the ledge library can find that in about 10 minutes. And we call Ben and we can have this answer within a day. But I think the simplest thing may be just to cut the Gordian knot and eliminate that language. And then this sister-in-law, brother-in-law, cousin-in-law, as long as there's no conflict of interest, it should be okay.
Certainly take that consideration to the sponsor, but the sponsor defers to the will of the committee on that.
All right. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think we have anybody here from the Department of Health and Social Services.
Yeah, we do.
Where who?
I think folks in the back.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that. because it's interesting, they provided an indeterminate fiscal note, and to me it's a very puzzling one, and at some point in the discussion I want to hear what the rationale could be, because it actually says that, you know, that there may be a cost because of the fact that the option of expanding the number of people that can be appointed also increases the option of more vulnerable adults being taken advantage of. And I was wondering how in the world they would make the call between the number of extra options for vulnerability against that which may be avoided because they've got a better choice. The court has a better choice, a broader choice, in who they select to represent the adult. And the reason that's appropriate to the topic on the table is that the Department of Health and Social Services will likely have input if we remove the language as has been suggested. So I just want to throw that on the table now. And incidentally, Madam Chair, I intend to make a motion, as the bill now stands, to eliminate that indeterminate fiscal note, go back to a zero fiscal note. I'm told that this showed up just today, and that makes me really uncomfortable anyway. But that was a sticking point for me as I looked at this bill, and I just wanted to let you know that's there, too.
Thank you, Representative Keller. Maybe we could have somebody from the Health and Social Services come before us and address that question. And please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the Deputy Director in Senior and Disability Services.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Through the chair, and to respond to Representative Keller, the Division of Senior in the Department submitted an indeterminate fiscal note because we know that we anticipate that while we appreciate the increased pool and opportunity for more conservators, we also know that there is a potential for more conflict of interest. So you're expanding the number of people who could have a potential of conflict of interest. And because a person is a conservatee, they are automatically a vulnerable adult. So we could see people who have a conflict of interest, or they could be a provider, so they could be providing care and be the conservator, we could see an increase in numbers of maltreatment reports. It's not, I'm not saying that we are going to have an increase in maltreatment. I'm just saying numbers of reports.
Got a question on that.
Follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up. would that not be just an extra burden on a court? And the court would have a broader spectrum of people they could pick from, and presumably they're, you know, in that broader spectrum, you could have both sides of the issue. You may have an option of appointing somebody that is more responsible or honest or whatever with a broader spectrum of choice.
Mm-hmm. So I've got a question here. The way it read before is a spouse, adult child, parent, sibling, etc. So if we eliminated one of those categories, would you have given us a negative fiscal note?
That's a through the chair. Thank you very much. We can't anticipate the numbers of maltreatment reports that will come in. So we can't put an estimate on that, but we do know that with a conflict of interest, we have more potential or less potential.
So you didn't answer my question, though. Would you have given us a negative fiscal note?
I would. I can't answer that question through the chair. Sorry.
Thank you. I'm still very uncomfortable with this fiscal note.
A quick follow-up. I don't remember you testifying before a committee. We don't typically kill a messenger. It's nice to meet you. And I'm sure we'll have a really good working relationship.
Madam Chair, does this represent a departure from past practice?
No, I've never seen Representative Kellner try to kill the messenger. Just one of the questioners.
We love you. You did a good job.
Representative Clayman.
So this is kind of the... And I appreciate your coming in. You probably had some advance notice that we had questions about the fiscal note. And I share some of those concerns. And as I understand this proposed amendment to the statute, it would basically mean an in-law could be appointed as a conservator, whereas today an in-law could not be appointed as conservator. And I'm just wondering, is there some evidence that the department has that in-laws, for example, are more likely to be taking advantage of seniors who are in a conservative situation than people that are related by blood?
Through the chair. It's a very good question. And an in-law, I just want to clarify, an in-law could become a conservator except for if they have a barring condition, a conflict of interest. With this new language, there's an exception, so they could have a conflict of interest. We do know that of the percentage of financial exploitation allegations that we investigate or even made to Adult Protection, approximately 45 or 47% involve a family member as the alleged perpetrator. And I can't, that does not speak to your question completely about conservatorship. However, we are unable to pull that information.
Follow up.
So would it be fair to say that if you've got 45 to 47% of the people that get investigated for taking advantage of conservatives are somehow family members, that probably, if anything, suggests that we should be looking outside the family for more of the conservatives rather than inside the family for conservators? Am I missing something, or?
Well, through the chair, the division is not taking a stand or an opinion upon whether a loved one would or wouldn't, or a family member would or wouldn't perpetrate financial exploitation. I was just simply letting you know that in the cases that we've received, the reports that we've received, approximately that many, and this is financial exploitation, not of by a conservator, it's just general financial exploitation, almost half are by family members.
So suffice it to say that being a family member does not prevent one from being accused of exploiting the senior.
Through the chair, no, it does not.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, this isn't so much for a question for you, but more for the room generally, because I've expressed some legal questions on whether this bill is the right way to cure the problem. I'd like the members to look at the bill, the text itself. Look at subsection B, which is the root of the problem. And what it says is the court...
Well, Representative Grunberg, if we don't have any more questions for anybody, what I'd actually like to do is have public hearing, and then we can open it up to the committee for discussion.
What I'd like, if I could, Madam Chair, to express a suggestion that maybe the witnesses can address in their testimony.
Go ahead.
Thank you. If the members would look at the text of the statute, which has been provided to everybody, looking at subsection B, which I think is the initial thing we need to look at here, and this deals with who can be appointed, and subsection B deals with who may not be appointed, and those are the people we're concerned with here. The first subsection says somebody who's likely to provide or provide services to the person. Number two, creditors. Number three, is likely to have during the conservatorship interests that may conflict with those of the protected person. It seems to me that's what you're really getting into. The others are just subsections of examples of people who may have conflicts of interest. And then sub D is if you're an employee of those people. It would seem to me the simplest way of cutting the Gordian knot here is to say the court may not appoint a person who is likely to have during the conservatorship interests that may conflict with the protected person or be employed by somebody like that. And I'm just wondering if people would like to comment on that as a possible solution, then you eliminate subsection C.
Why don't we keep that in mind? And I think we have one person online for testimony, and I'm going to then open it up for public testimony. Thank you. And we have Darren Colbury online. Darren, would you like to identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Darren Colbury, and I'm a person that is a protective ward by my dad. My dad is my conservator, and I am for this bill because what it is me and my wife, we both have conservator. I have my dad as a conservator, and then we have like a family friend that is a conservator for my wife. And what it is my wife would like to have my dad as my conservator because we live with my parents, and my parents knows what we need and how to do our finances and everything, so our finances can be together instead of being separate. And I know my dad could do a good job, but what it is the courts kept saying that that my dad cannot be my wife's conservator because my wife lives with us, and that they're like classified as like rental property owners because they're kind of, you know, renting to us so we could, you know, like pay for food and electricity and everything to help with the household budget.
Thank you. So does anybody have any questions for Mr. Colbury? Right, hearing no questions, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Appreciate your being here with us today. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Well, seeing no one, I will close public testimony, and we can bring this bill back to the committee. So you had a question, or you had
a thought. And I don't need to take people's time now, but and I'm kind of looking at you, Seal. That what I'd like to do is take a very brief period of time to check with the uniform commissioners and see why they had drafted it like this. It seems a very cumbersome way of doing it, and we may be able to do exactly what you want in a much simpler way. And if I can, I'm not trying to harm the bill at all. I'm trying to see what we can do that will accomplish the end and make it real simple.
I don't have any problems with that. I think I'm going to hold this bill. And, Seal, can you get the answers and work with Representative Grunberg on that? And
Madam Chair, I'd welcome anybody, your staff, who wants to join us with the sponsor and your permission. And my intent is to get that Uniform Act, look at the annotations, and get a call in to the commissioners and see what's going on here. And I'll have a report next meeting.
All right. Sounds good. And Ms. Etheridge, maybe you'd like to, in the meantime, reconsider your fiscal note for us. All right. We're going to take a brief at ease here. Call the committee back to order again.
It's still your trial.
Right. So you don't need to say by adoption because the definition of child covers it.
We have a continuation of House Bill number 79, the marijuana bill. And there is a House Judiciary CS. Could I please have a motion to adopt the draft CS to have it before us for discussion purposes?
Madam Chair, I move CS for House Bill number 79, Judiciary, and that's LS-0409-PAPA-P for the work drafting purpose.
Thank you. So,
no objection.
No. Seeing no objections, this draft CS is before the committee for purposes of discussion. So, we have with us here my Judiciary aide, Thomas Brown, to guide us through it and to tell us what some of the changes were, the more pertinent ones from the previous CS. Again, this is a work in progress. We are, along with the other body, we're trying to work parallel with the same drafts before us so that we're going to so that hopefully we can get this thing completed before the drop-dead date of February 24th, which is the date that marijuana becomes legal in this state. So, Mr. Brown, do you want to continue?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Thomas Brown, staff to Representative Ledoux. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, House Bill 79 would revise some of Alaska's criminal statutes to ensure that the will of the electorate is respected by cleaning up some of the now contradictory laws regarding marijuana. The CS before you, version P, is still a work in progress. We fixed the central complaint against the original draft in that it merely provided a defense for conduct involving marijuana instead of making the conduct itself lawful. This draft is a big step towards getting to that goal. I'd like to remind the committee that the first draft was 9 pages. The draft that I presented last time was 47 pages. This draft is now 91 pages. The sectional analysis I'm going to read to you itself is 13 pages. I beg your patience.
And before you begin, I'd like to note that Representative Millett, the birthday girl, has joined us.
Note to self.
It's before February 24th.
Continue, Mr. Brown.
Okay. A good portion of this new CS and House Bill 79 are conforming amendments. The vast majority of them are, as a matter of fact. Also, since the bill removes marijuana from the list of controlled substances, a number of statutes had to be amended to re-include marijuana, as those statutes no longer apply to marijuana. Basically, some new crimes also had to be created to reflect the new reality of legal marijuana. So now I'd like to go through the CS for House Bill 79, version P. Basically, sections 1 through 44 are almost entirely conforming amendments, some large, some small. The first new section is section 2, defining the prohibition of marijuana use as a condition for setting probation. Section 9, 10, and 11 are also new sections from the previous version. Section 9 reestablishes the liability of someone who commits a felony while under the influence of marijuana for personal injury or wrongful death. Section 10 reestablishes that someone driving a car not under the influence of marijuana or driving on behalf of someone reasonably believed to be under the influence of marijuana cannot be held liable beyond the limits of their individual insurance policy. Section 11, mere conforming amendment. Section 32 is a new section. It restrains the court from sentencing to imprisonment defendants not on parole or probation to be found in violation of statutes now inapplicable. In a discussion with the drafters yesterday, it is highly recommended that we strip this section entirely, that we repeal the entire section, as it is very cumbersomely worded. It refers to former statutes that are no longer in existence, and there's a better way to do it. So look forward to the next version in which we'll clean that up a little bit. Section 42 directs the Department of Health and Social Services to include both marijuana and alcohol in the department's existing educational programs to deter and prevent substance abuse. The next two sections provide affirmative defenses for registered caregivers charged with offenses related to marijuana. Minor technical change in that to reflect the new version.
So I'd like to go back to section 42 for a second. So previously, this section just related to controlled substances, which included marijuana.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So in an effort to regulate marijuana like alcohol, what we've basically done is add to the work of the Health and Social Services Commission that we're now adding alcohol, just to be fair.
Madam Chair, that is also correct.
Continue.
Did you say it is correct?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So sections 45 through 49 have to deal with the provisions allowed by marijuana establishments, from retail to cultivation, product manufacturing, and testing facilities, and what is or is not allowed for each of those facilities under law, and what the basic licensing code is going to be when the regulatory structure of marijuana is decided.
Ms. Brown, do we have anybody to explain to us? Can you or anybody else? I'm looking for somebody in the room, or maybe the Department of Law or the court system. We've taken out the notwithstanding any other provision of the law, and I guess I'm trying to figure out why that was taken out.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that we do have somebody either hopefully in the audience, but if not online, that can explain that. That's better versed than I am, but I can tell you that the way it was explained to me is that this sentence, notwithstanding any other provision of law, would unnecessarily restrict local governments and future legislators from amending this portion of the law. They strengthened these four provisions by adding a section in the very end establishing that the regulatory power of the state over marijuana.
Okay. They're going over the work draft, which is right here.
Hello?
Where
did that come from?
I forgot to push mute.
Who is it from who might be able to answer those questions?
Through the chair, I was hoping that either Jean Michelle or Hillary Martin from Ledge Legal would be online to help out with that, and also that somebody from the courts and law would be in the room that also might be able to help out that.
Miss Jean Michelle, are you online? Okay. Hillary Morgan, are you online? Hillary Martin, are you online? Is there anybody from the Department of Law here that might be able to?
Mr. Savani, sir.
I see him ducking.
Move the bill.
Mr. Sabade, would you like to come up here and perhaps help us out here?
Madam Chair, this is Rick Sabade. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. No, I can't help you out. I will confess, having looking up that phrase just the other day to make sure I understood what it meant, and I still have difficulty. I don't know what it does, because the legislature can always change both a statute, to me it has no meaning one way or the other. I mean, so I'm sorry I'm not very helpful with that, but when I looked it up, the definition wasn't.
All right. I guess we're going to have to wait until we get Ms. Martin online. Sorry for the interruption, Thomas. And thank you very much, Rick.
This is Thomas Brown again, staff representative Ledoux. So other than the notwithstanding any other provision of law being deleted from these sections, there's no other real changes to these from the previous versions. Section 50 describes the crimes of misconduct in the first, second, third, and fourth degree and classifies them accordingly, allowing for penalties accordingly, and defining related terms. Changes include it redefines possession from 1 ounce to 4 ounce to conform with precedent. It makes possession of between 24 plants a second degree misdemeanor. Makes possession by minors under the age of 18 a third degree. Does allow 21-year-olds to enter a marijuana establishment at the lawful request of a peace officer. Mandates that people transporting more than 1 ounce of marijuana must keep their valid registration on them at all times and to provide it to a peace officer for inspection upon request. Establishes the calculation measures for live marijuana plants, allowing for rehabilitation of offenders, restricting prosecution for persons related to overdose, and defining what may be forfeited or seized in relation to marijuana offenses. All of that is new in this section from the previous section.
And this is Section 50, correct?
Section 50.
Okay, so I guess I just want to clarify for the committee. This actually, as far as the possession of marijuana is concerned, this allows more than the amount allowed pursuant to the initiative, but conforms with the Raven decision?
Madam Chair, that is correct, yes.
Thank you.
4 ounces under Raven, 1 ounce by the ballot initiative. And yeah.
Thank you.
The next two sections, 51, 52, are sort of new sections. They're, again, conforming amendments, mainly defining the terms marijuana, manufacture of marijuana, marijuana concentrates. 57, about the next 20 sections are all.
Sorry to keep interrupting you again, but I noticed that salt is out of that.
Madam Chair, salt was removed because the way I understand it, and don't laugh too much, apparently the initiative drafters took the language from some other initiative in some other state, and nobody involved has any idea what marijuana salt is. It apparently was an accident. So that's why that's been removed. Nobody knows what salt is, so that's why it's gone.
And thank you. Representative Klayman, your hand was up. Do you know what salt marijuana salt is?
I only know this because I'm fairly certain of what it is, because in my household we have this interest of flavored salts, and so you can get truffle salt, and you can get truffle salt is one. You can get basil salt, basically salts that are infused with flavors. And I would bet, although I have no problem with taking the language, and I would bet that marijuana salt means salt infused with marijuana.
That's would we still
learn so much?
Would that come under then an edible?
Sure. Madam Chair, as a former cook, probably. That's as much as my expertise goes on that. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. To continue. From 57 on, I believe until 76 or so, are all new sections, generally dealing with testing, drug testing, now defined as marijuana testing, because marijuana is now no longer a drug. It is no longer a controlled substance. So anything related to drug testing by employers no longer includes marijuana. We had to rewrite every statute dealing with controlled substance testing by employers to now re-include marijuana. So it establishes what actions an employer may or may not take against their employees for testing positive and or negative on a test, establishes what they may test for, how they may test, the standards by which they test, record keeping based on the test, confidentiality of the test results, so forth and so on. Provides protections against the employer from defamation or slander dealing with the test. Allows employers to test prospective employees, not just current employees, and guards the employer from retribution or legal action based on the results of those tests. It requires the employer to pay the entire cost for marijuana testing, record keeping, sanitary conditions, allows for on-site testing, training requirements of test administrators, and the disciplinary procedures a employer may take based on the results. Sections 77 and 78 prohibit workers' compensation claims by employees whose injuries were caused either directly or proximately by the intoxication of marijuana. 79 is a holdover from the previous version, allowing for parental visitation rights to be conditioned on the abstention of marijuana use.
Madam Chair.
Representative Klayman.
I just want to go back to Section 77. I'm sorry. I'm going in the wrong place. All right, Section 77. It looks like in the existing proposal that was just A3 is the injury is not proximately caused by the intoxication of the injured, and now it's limiting, seems to be limiting that to alcohol and marijuana. Can you explain how that would relate if the employer suspected there was intoxication or some altered mental state related to other illegal drugs?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I believe that's a drafting error.
Which brings me to, apparently, Ms. Michelle and maybe Hillary Martin are on the line now. Maybe we can ask them about that. Ms. Michelle or Ms. Martin, are you there? You're not? They're not? Okay. Well, we will remember it for when they do call in.
Follow up. I'm not quite sure I know what the answer is, but I just the topic of intoxication as it relates to workers' compensation claims is, I certainly don't think we want to limit it to alcohol and marijuana if there's other substances at issue. And I'm not sure whether my query would be whether it should just be approximately caused by intoxication without defining intoxication by what. I don't know the answer. It's just a question.
Well, when we get them on the line, but it would appear to me that it might read due to intoxication from alcohol, marijuana, or another controlled substance.
That might work, too.
Proceed.
That might be Section 78, too. Sorry to interrupt, but Section 78 looks like it has the same drafting topic.
Proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the Chair, thank you, Representative Clayman, for pointing out more things to do.
By the 24th.
Okay, so sections, we left off on Section 79, Sections 80 through... 90-something, all have to do with driving statutes. Again, since marijuana is no longer a controlled substance, we had to rewrite everything having to do with DUIs and getting your license and having your license revoked to reflect that marijuana is no longer covered just naturally under the controlled substances label. So... Section 80 requires that the marijuana is in the list of substances that could incur a DUI, pertaining to the requirement that ignition interlock devices can be applied to all DUI crimes.
I'm confused here when we talk about interlock devices. When it's alcohol, you blow on it. How does the interlock device recognize marijuana?
Madam Chair, respectfully, I was confused by that, too. I honestly don't know.
All right, one more thing for the next draft. Maybe when we get Legislegal on the line, they can help us understand that.
Sections 81 adds marijuana to the list of substances that, if used habitually to the degree that the person is incapable of safely driving, precludes the department from issuing a driver's license to that person. 82 pertains to disqualifications from being issued a school bus driver's license, adding marijuana to the list of substances. Again, almost all of this is basically conforming language. It's all conforming amendments to one degree or another.
And understanding correctly that marijuana had been included before because it was a controlled substance, and that all of these things that marijuana is going to preclude you from doing, alcohol is also listed.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Section 84 adds marijuana to the list of substances that every applicant for a driver's license must undergo a test of the applicant's knowledge of the laws and effects of the list of substances. 85 adds marijuana to the list of substances that a person applying for a new license... Okay, I'm going to have to take credit for this mistake. I left off the end of the sentence, so that's my error.
What section are we on?
Section 85, Madam Chair. Basically, it says that anyone applying for a new license after expiration of the person's license must pass the test regarding alcohol, marijuana, and drug awareness and safety, and the laws, the traffic laws pertaining to those substances.
Okay.
My apologies for leaving that off of the sectional.
Representative Mehmet.
So that's on page 54. What line would it
be? Through the chair, Representative Mehmet, it begins on page 53, section 85, and basically line 2 on page 54, line 1 and line 2. A person applying for a new license after expiration of the person's license on reaching 21 years of age must pass a test developed and administered by the department regarding alcohol, marijuana, and drug awareness and safety, and the laws relating to alcohol, marijuana, drugs, and driving before the license may be issued or renewed.
What is it supposed to say?
The sectional itself is an error, not the.
Oh,
not
oh okay.
I added something to the brownie. Sorry.
I thought he had quite a sway over legal.
Okay. So sections.
We don't count the messenger around here.
Sections 86, 87, and 88 are just administrative qualifications, basically disqualifications, actually. Again, conforming amendments, chemical sobriety tests, and DUI inclusions. Section 89 adds marijuana to the list of substances that can occur a DUI or a refusal, which will lead to immediate license revocation.
Representative Mellon.
This is a silly question, but just work with me for a second. So I see we're adding to the DUI statutes marijuana. Can you tell me how we test for marijuana under the influence of marijuana in a DUI scenario? Lifeline?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I don't suppose we could ask Rick to come back up here?
I think that would be an excellent suggestion. And why don't we get Rick a chair, too? Because I think Rick may be there for a while.
Are we on page 56?
Yes, we are.
Oops, sorry. Answer it off the page.
Just a silly little question.
We do now, though.
Huh?
We do now.
Blood test at the station.
Hmm?
Blood test at the station.
For the record, Madam Chair, I am Rick Spodney, Deputy Attorney General. And the question was, how do we test for marijuana in DUI cases today? Mm-hmm. I guess that's the question. Through the Chair, Representative Millett, what tends to happen, the easy answer is we send it to the Washington State Crime Lab. They do toxicology and send the report back to us, but I think I need to explain that a little bit more.
What
will typically happen is a police officer will observe some erratic behavior. There'll be symptoms that they see about the person. They may not have the coordination that they should have or the thinking process. They'll arrest the person for DUI. They'll take them to a location where there's an intoximeter, which measures breath alcohol. If the result of that intoximeter is, say, 0.20, that's it. They'll charge the person with the theory of being under the influence of alcohol. It may be that they also have marijuana on board, but the police stop at that point. If the breath result is 0.000 and they see that there's this impairment, then they go and they get a search warrant from a court and get a a sample of the person's blood, which is sent to the Washington State Crime Lab. They do a toxicology on kind of the common drugs, including marijuana, send a report back here, here to the state of Alaska. The crime lab has a grant. Our Alaska State Crime Lab doesn't do analysis of blood. They have a federal grant that pays for sending it out of state and getting the reports, and actually sometimes pays for, always pays for the crime lab people to come up and testify about the results and what those results tend to mean. We don't have presumptive levels of being under the influence of marijuana, so we need both expert testimony and toxicology, what it is and what it means, that 0.5 nanograms per milliliter suggests that the person's under the influence. The states are equally split between 2 nanograms and 5 nanograms per milliliter. We need an expert where we don't need an expert in the alcohol arena, because we've set limits by statute.
Follow-up? Certainly.
So if someone gets pulled over and they don't have any blood alcohol level, and then they're still considered, they get the search warrant, they do the blood test, are they arrested while you send off the blood test to Washington State right now? Are they held, or are they let go? Or
through the chair, Representative Millett, they are arraigned within 24. Well, they're it depends on where you're at. I mean, if the judicial district has a bail schedule, you'll be released from the bail from the jail on that bail schedule. If they don't have a bail schedule, if they're in Anchorage, they just call up what they call the committing magistrate, and the committing magistrate will set bail at that time. In the other communities, they would be appear before court the next business day, and the court would set bail.
Do you anticipate, or are there out there any science in which this might be able to be done a lot more quickly? Just like the DUI. I mean, at some point, those toximeters must have been invented. Is there anything out there that is on the verge of entering the marketplace?
Madam Chair, as I understand it, there are companies who claim to have developed devices that can test through breath. I think the one that looks kind of most promising is from Canada, but I know that there's a company in Colorado. But you're looking at 5 years down the line, because they're in the development stage, and then after the development, legislatures will be passing laws, and then the machines will be have to be gone through a scientific process to make sure that they're operating, that the science is good and that they're operating correctly. So it's probably about, my guess, if we keep having states go the way Alaska has gone, it'll probably speed up a little bit, but my guess is probably 4 or 5 years out before you get something like that.
But the science likely will catch up with the law.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Representative Clayman.
Just to make sure I'm tracking the discussion accurately, there was a criminal investigation of a driver in Anchorage who had hit a bicyclist a couple of years ago, and I got a lot of attention in the press in Anchorage. I'm not sure it filtered down to what's going on in Juneau, but they ultimately elected not to prosecute because even though the driver had, his blood showed that he had marijuana in his system or THC in his system, the absence of a standard that qualified as intoxication made the prosecutors conclude that they didn't have a basis to go forward. And I'm not asking you to comment on if you were part of internal discussions about the case. I'm not asking for those comments, but just trying to get it. This is that same issue about what qualifies as intoxication.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, if I understand your question correctly, yes. I mean, we have some general guidelines. We know that roughly five states have said 5 nanograms, you're impaired, and roughly five states have said 2 nanograms, you're impaired. A lot of states have said if you have any alcohol, it's just a, excuse me, any marijuana, it's just a per se violation like we do with kids. You know, if you have any alcohol on board and you're driving a car and you're under 21, that's an offense whether you're under the influence of it or not. The example, I don't recall, I recall specifically examples in Anchorage of a couple people on bicycles dying in the last couple of years. I don't know your particular case, but I could tell you, for example, when it must be 10 years ago, or so, where a corrections van was hit by a semi-truck and several, 6 inmates died, and I think two corrections officers died. I actually looked at that case. The driver had an amount of Valium in his system, and it was very difficult to make a decision as to what made you impaired. And that person's in that example, the toxicologists know basically the half-life of Valium, and it was at an amount that was at a therapeutic level, the person having taken it the day before, and it didn't. So to me, the person wasn't under the influence, and we didn't charge that person for the in a situation where there was multiple deaths.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, and thank you, Rick. Do you have, looks like you want to say
one more quick question, sure, just to show off a little bit?
Sure, go right ahead.
I know what assault is because I had to ask the same question, and I asked the state crime lab director, who's a chemist. And if you take, like, table salt, it's, you know, it's sodium and it's chloride, and it's the ions between the two of them, when the molecules mix, that's a salt, and that's why we call sodium and chloride together salt. So it's the combination of particular molecules, and the state crime lab director said for marijuana it is not it's not a necessary part of the definition. It's been there for at least 30 years, so.
Representative Grunberg.
I'm sorry I missed a lot of this, and I'm going to ask you a question. And if it's been asked before, I apologize, but I'll still ask it. We in my office tend to look at newspaper articles from all around the country that may be of interest. And it's very interesting. If anybody has an interest in that, I can help. But one of the headlines I've seen just within the last day or so, I haven't read the article, that one state, and I think it may be Minnesota, is getting away from the concept of bail. And I know no more about it than that. And I realize this may be a little bit off subject, but do you know anything about that?
Representative Grunberg, we've got about 40 pages more of this bill, and we've got a whole bunch of people on the line.
I'll pass on that one.
So, to deal with the concept of bail,
we'll get out. If you know anything, please see me afterwards.
Representative Keller.
Rick, if I could, before you go.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. This is
one row back.
This is off topic, but it keeps coming up in my mind, and I think the Department of Law might be able to help us. Is there a way to come up with a one-page, two-page timeline description of actually what happens in this process, a timeline? There's a lot of people out there watching us with bated breath. And as I understand it, the only thing that happens on February 24th of this year is that the possession and use issue, you know, is okay for if you're over 21 years of age. And then, as I understand it, there will be no marijuana sold, couldn't possibly be sold, until in 2016. And then you got a time lag even after that for the licensure. What I'm asking is if the Department of Law could come up with some kind of a visual that we could, you know, have not only for ourselves but for those that are watching this, so that it might eliminate some confusion in the whole process.
Through the chair, if I may, I'm not. Let me start from a little bit different point. The sky is not going to fall down if this bill doesn't pass by the 24th. 2 weeks from today, right? We're still going to. There will be legal issues that will be in dispute. For example, what do you do with hash oil? And people have different interpretations of what those will be. We aren't going to treat people driving under the influence of marijuana any differently than we are today. We're going to go through the same process that I described to Representative Millett. It almost is more helpful to deal from the prosecution and the police point of view. It's almost more helpful to deal with the regulatory issues first, and then move to the criminal issues. So I'm not quite sure what you mean. I can easily, and I can have it for you tomorrow. You know, we know what happens on the 24th. The initiative takes effect, but the regulatory parts don't take effect till the regulations are done, and then there's a certain number of days there, and we're really kind of into 2016 before everything is in place. Is that what you're asking for? Because it's only like four or five steps. But if you're asking for something...
Thank you, Rick. It is simplistic, and that's part of the reason I hesitated asking you, and I wouldn't be surprised where you could say, go make your own timeline. But I was just thinking it would be helpful if it came from the Department of Law, and I realize it is something that you could easily produce and quickly. It just might eliminate confusion.
I will, through the chair, I'll have it to the committee tomorrow if I don't have it in my binder now.
Thank you. Representative Klayman.
On that particular topic about sort of what happens on February 24th if we don't do anything, I was going to distribute it later. I'm not going to discuss it today, but I actually asked Legislative Legal to prepare a memo about what is the bare minimum that we could do and just sort of let the voters thing pass. And I'm going to go ahead and share this memo with the committee. I'll just give it to the assistants to distribute, but no need to talk about it today, but I think it addresses some of the same questions that Representative Keller is bringing up.
Thank you. Proceed.
For the record, this is Thomas Brown again. Okay, Section 90, I think, is where we were. Section 90 includes marijuana into the administrative license revocation statutes as it relates to the crime of a minor operating a vehicle after consuming alcohol. 91, also a new section, basically reinserts marijuana and marijuana abuse into the juvenile ASAP program, if such is required before issuing a new license. 92 adds marijuana to a provision referencing the crime of a minor operating a vehicle after consuming alcohol. 93 adds marijuana to provide that the court shall report to the department every legal change of name of any person considered to be afflicted with a mental disability or is an habitual user of alcohol, marijuana, or another drug. 94 adds marijuana to the section of law that requires the court to surrender someone's ID, enables the court to order a person from refraining from marijuana consumption in the same fashion as alcohol. 95 returns marijuana to the statutes relating to conditions of parole. 96. If a person has been ordered to refrain from consuming alcoholic beverages under Title IV, they can have their issuance of new license suspended. For insurance purposes, Section 97 adds marijuana to the list of substances that can incur a DUI or refusal. 98, again, basically DUI statute, returning marijuana to it, conforming amendment. 99, same. 100, again, returns marijuana to the list of substances that are prohibited from being consumed in the past 4 hours while operating a commercial motor vehicle. Also includes possession. 101, again, refers to commercial motor vehicles and returns marijuana to substances that is an offense that are grounds for immediate disqualification from driving a commercial vehicle. Uh, 102 and 103 just provide definitions. 104 stipulates that an open container, basically open the next 6 sections are all open container laws, similar to what we have for alcohol. We want to regulate it like alcohol. We need something similar about marijuana, and this defines relevant terms and prohibits an open container of marijuana from being in a car, and you know adds the exceptions to it. One 109 and 110 are implied consent laws, re-adding returning marijuana to the list of substances associated with DUIs. 111 is about chemical tests, again returning marijuana.
We're in section 111?
Yes, sir. Through the chair.
You must have skipped a few.
We are on, section 111, through the chair, Representative Groenberg, or section 111 in the...
I didn't hear anything about the others. Like 108 and stuff, did you cover that stuff?
I've just kind of, for the purposes of brevity, through the chair, Representative Groenberg, for the purposes of brevity, I was just lumping them as close together as possible. Or I can go point by point if you'd like me to.
As Mae West would say, I get your drift.
Thank you for your kindness. So 112... after refusal to submit to a chemical test, just conforming amendment, re-adds, returns marijuana to the list of controlled substances, not the list of controlled substances, but they're a definition close to for the purposes of refusal of chemical tests.
Mr. Brown, I'm wondering for the purposes of, so that we can get through this a little quicker, could we go simply to the areas in which it's not simply a conforming amendment? That's the pleasure of the committee also, because I think most of us can read and see where it's simply conforming.
Madam Chair, that would also be my pleasure, so I will do just that.
Thomas, you're doing a great job, by the way.
Madam Chair, in that case, I believe actually I'm pretty much finished. There is nothing actually new that after that point. Actually, after about 40 points ago. But
what about the seizure section? Is the seizure section just conform and add marijuana to where we would have done seizures with respect to alcoholic beverages by a violation of the alcohol? Beverage and Control Act?
You mean the forfeitures and seizures?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. We're just, again, regulating like alcohol. We're just adding language to make sure that that it's similar.
Okay. Anybody have any questions, brief questions for Mr. Brown before we go into, we've got about 10 people who want to testify.
I just have a question for you. You were talking about the seizure section. Where is that in the bill? Just so I can follow.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I believe that begins on section 50, which would be page of the bill 40-something.
I'll find it.
Section 50 is on page 29 of the bill, of the CS, and I believe there's also other areas that also have forfeiture and seizure statutes.
Oh, page 33, line 30.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that is correct. Yeah, that would be section 50, exactly. And specifically pages 33 and 34, I believe, yes.
Okay. Then I would like to open this up for public testimony. We have a number of people online. And so the first person that I'm going to call is Michelle Holly from Soldotna. And Michelle, could you please identify yourself and tell us with whom you're affiliated?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. I would like to give my utmost thanks to you, your committee, and all your staff for the hard work that you're doing on this House Bill 79.
Thank you.
It's amazing how well you are working this through. I know it's very difficult for you. With that being said, we have some lingering issues. This version of the bill is a significant step in the right direction, I feel, and the committee members should absolutely be applauded for what they are doing here. Still, there's some concerns remaining in repealing or significantly modifying any portion of this voter-enacted initiative would be unconstitutional. I have before me a copy of Raven and a copy of the Act as it is, and I'm sure there are lawyers that can sort this out much better than I can. But being a 62-year resident of this state, I think it's imperative that we move on this bill now. Day by day, all across this country and across the world, more and more people are finding out more information about this substance. I might, Madam Chairman, you asked about the science relating to DUI studies. I would be happy to provide everything that I have found out about this substance in the last 3.5 years, but what I'm holding in my hand right here is a new National Highway Transportation Safety Administration came out this Friday with a huge statement suggesting or saying outright that marijuana use has not been found to increase the risk of car crashes, according to a new federal report. They have a big study. It ended in 2012. They've taken a look at it. And as of Friday, they have said that there is no relation between car crashes and marijuana. So I would suggest we take a look at that when we're moving forward. Again, it's new news. There's no reason anybody would know that. Okay? So the legislature must preserve all the legal protections that are supported by the voters. I think that is the most important thing here. And the legislature must not repeal Section 17.38.020 of Measure 2, which makes it unlawful for adults 21 and older to possess, use, produce marijuana for personal use. It's essential that AS 17.38.020 remains on the books so that adults' personal use activities related to marijuana are not subject to arrest, forfeiture, or penalties under the local ordinances. The Measure 20, or Measure 2, provides that adults age 21 and older may grow up to 6 plants and possess all the marijuana produced from these plants on those premises. The legislation must not ignore this important provision by criminalizing any possession over 1 ounce without creating an exception for the marijuana that has been personally produced. The committee should continue its work to revise House Bill 79 and Senate Bill 30 to comply with the will of the voters. And that concludes my talk on this.
Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Holly? Well, thank you very much for appearing by telephone and offering your comments. We appreciate it. And we are going to try to do the will of the people. Rest assured. The next person we've got online is Tina Curtis. Tina, can you identify yourself for the record and tell us whom you represent? Tina, are you online? Well, I guess she is no longer with us. So the next person would be Leif Abel.
Ma'am, I'm here. Sorry.
You're Tina?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Please identify yourself and tell us whom you represent and then proceed.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Tina Hardcastle Curtis.
On a line again, we're working. Okay, Ms. Curtis, sorry for that interruption, but we had lost our power, so continue.
Okay. My main concerns were about the part of the bill that, well, I'll explain what I do. I've been growing my own medicine for the last 15 years.
Hold on a second. You're breaking up. No, she's off now.
Okay, is this better now?
Yes, much better.
Okay. I want to make sure that Raven is still intact because even under the medical law, I have multiple sclerosis and I have to, I had a $12,000 a month pharmaceutical bill that I was trying to reduce, and I was able to do that, but I have to grow at least between 3 to 5 different strains in order to control both my symptoms. I have done that and reduced my pharmaceutical bill down to less than $200. But I'm going to have more than what the medical law allows, stuff too. And I just want to make sure that y'all consider that when you, and the law that we're able to still grow as much and possess what we need under, you know, personal law.
So, Ms. Curtis, are you able to grow what you need with 6 plants?
No, ma'am.
How many does it take you?
I usually have somewhere between 18 and 24. In order to make sure that I have enough medication all the time. And I've managed to do that. At least for the last 8 years I have. And, but it's the only way I can control, there's no way to control some of my symptoms without it. There's nothing else that controls them. And I have severe insomnia too, and I finally, have a strain now that, I was anyway, never able to sleep more than 2 hours in a row for like the last 10 years until recently. And when I got the strain going, the first night I smoked some, I was able to, I slept 6 hours straight, and I haven't slept 6 hours straight in probably 20 years. My neurologist was very happy that I finally found something where I could finally sleep again. So it's just with what I have, there's just too many things to control. The neuropathies are really bad, and I was at assisted living, and they let me smoke because they were so bad I was screaming, And the same thing happened at Alaska Regional Hospital back in October. And they, I make pills out of it too. I don't always have to smoke it. And they, the doctor was so impressed that I, about the fact that I recovered. For 4 days I couldn't control some of my symptoms. And once I started taking my pills, I had it under control in less than a day. And the doctor was very impressed by that. He didn't believe it before that, he said. And the other thing I was concerned about was your blood tests. Hopefully they've improved them over the last 5 years. 5 years ago, I took a blood test, and I had the doctor didn't want me to smoke anything, and I had not touched any marijuana in the 28 days between the appointments. Well, when the blood test came back, they tried to tell me that the lab and the chemist told them that I had smoked that same, I had to have smoked that same day, according to the test. Well, I had not smoked that same day. But then I've been smoking marijuana every day for 15 years, so I don't, it builds up in your system, so some tests, I don't know how they're going to, hopefully the newer tests will be able to show the difference. And I was very glad the lady that testified before about the transportation department's research, because I believe that is true. To be honest with you, I've had several careers. I fixed computers for a living before I was disabled. And I have smoked marijuana regularly for 40 years. It's not affected anything except for helping me unwind after busy days. I worked
so,
on
So Ms. Curtis, I don't want to be nosy, but what disease are you suffering from that marijuana helps?
Mainly, I have multiple sclerosis.
I can't hear you?
I have multiple sclerosis.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for your comments. We will certainly take those into consideration when we continue considering this bill. We really appreciate your taking the time to testify.
Well, thank you, and I thank all of you for all your time and your efforts in getting this bill enacted.
Thank you. All right, the next person that I've got is Leif Abel. Leif, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, do you want to tell us, identify yourself for the record and tell us whom you represent?
For the record, my name is Leif Abel. I'm from Kisilov, Alaska. Through the chair, I would like to address a couple of concerns I have with the current version of SB 30. First, though, I would like to thank you guys for all of your hard work and your wonderful questions and your willingness to really look at this topic, which is hard because a lot of people aren't really educated on this. So I commend you guys' hard work and how quickly everybody's coming up to speed on this. This is great, and I appreciate that. This newest version is obviously way better, and I feel like you guys are moving in the right direction. I did have a couple of concerns. I think that if we're going to have a regulated industry where we possibly, there will be businesses in the state selling marijuana to tourists, I think we need to think about how we define public and where they might be consuming the marijuana that they get. And by that, I mean that we may need to think about, the initiative says regulate marijuana like alcohol. So, I mean, in a responsible fashion, a business should be able to have a smoking establishment, much like a bar, or events possibly should be able to have an area much like a beer garden. And so that's my comment on that one. As to consumption in general, I feel like there's been something missed a little bit in the discussion as it relates to public and in consumption in general. Unlike alcohol, marijuana is consumed in a variety of ways, whether it be smoking, vapor, a tea, a salve, some other sort of edible. And so I know that some concerns about public consumption may be based around the actual smoke And this I've heard from people in the public who don't consume at all. They're worried about, hey, I don't want, you know, my kid or myself to have to smell marijuana. And that would, and marijuana smoke, and because they're concerned about secondhand effects and whatnot. And I think that with the edibles and arguably with the vapors and definitely with edibles in the cells, there's going to be no secondhand effect. And so that's just one note that I wanted to add and include in there. And that, you know, it may, I realize that the medical users in the state do have some more rights beyond what are being discussed here, but I can't help but to think that even if, you know, we instate some broad language about not using in public, that the medical patients might get hassled more as well. And I'll move on quickly here. I also would like to agree with a previous commenter that 17.38.020 and 17.38.030 should be retained in this as they were part of the original initiative. And I think there's some confusion among the public on on the definition of possession and whether we're referring to possession within the home or legal possession from transport, possession while transporting, say, from your home to someone else's home or another legal area where you might be consuming. So we've been talking about a lot of different amounts here, anywhere from 4 ounces to all that you can grow on the 6 plants. I think it would be very helpful to address this so that the public understands when we're talking about in-home possession versus transport possession. And I think the language is a little confusing there. Also, I'd like to add that I feel like extracts should not be banned for home use, partly because they're one of the best ways to create edibles, and edibles, you know, are one of the most common ways to consume medically. And even if you're just a recreational user, I would hate to discourage someone from eating marijuana instead of smoking it, since, you know, we don't fully understand the effects of smoke in the lungs. So that would conclude my points, and I really appreciate your time today. Thank you once again.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next person is Robert Davis from Houston. Robert, do you want to identify yourself and tell us who you represent?
Hi, I'm Robert Davis. I live in Houston, and hopefully I'm representing the 53% of the voters that voted for this initiative to begin with. I could go over the rhetoric that everybody else is talking about here, how the legislature should keep 17.38.020 in the measure, but that's already been gone over quite extensively, I feel. And you do have some other issues before you, like how intoxicated is a person when they're using pot, and are they not intoxicated? Well, the 5 nanograms that the guy was talking about, 2 to 5 nanograms that he was talking about earlier, that can remain in a person's body for several days, if not weeks, and maybe even a month. I'm not really well-versed on that, but I can tell you that there are other ways to use this plant, and some of the new ways that have just been found out are juicing the leaves and using the raw cannabis juice to help take care of medical problems. There recently has been a girl that was cured of lupus by using the cannabis juice, and this is a new method. And that's why it's so important to get this thing passed, because there are so many new things that are coming out, and a lot of people are being helped. And the reason the juicing is so effective is because the THC and the CBD is not changed from its original raw compound and changed into the compound where you get high from THC. If you use it in its raw form juice, through the use of leaves, you don't get high. You don't even know you consumed it, except for the fact that it helps you with some of your medical maladies. And I just like to emphasize again that the Raven Law should also remain intact, because it takes at least 30 leaves a day. Now, this is considered the trash part of the plant, which really is now becoming a very important part of the plant, but it takes at least 30 to 40 leaves a day of that much plant, of the plant to juice for that to be effective for a medical person. And that's why it's important to keep at least 24 plants legal to grow in your household per patient, because that's quite a few leaves. And after a while, your leaves would be all dried up if you just left it at six plants. You couldn't do it. But I'd like to thank the legislature and for all your hard work. And I know you have a lot of lingering issues on this bill, but you should be applauded for all your efforts. And I, for one, really do appreciate it. I'd just like to see that this bill absolutely gets passed as it was intended. Because if it doesn't and you change it and you want to criminalize it, it completely defeats the reason for this bill. You must preserve all the legal protections supported by the voters, as it would be unconstitutional for the legislature not to do that. And once again, I thank you. And if you have any questions or concerns, somebody there knows how to get in touch with me. You can. I've got a lot of information that I've looked up about it, that I've studied this for quite a few years myself. And as far as that goes, I think that maybe perhaps someone in the state should consider hiring some people that really know what they're doing in this field and just, you know, trying to piecemeal together something without experienced, qualified individuals to help you. Okay? Thank you. That's it.
Thank you very much. Next person we've got is Timothy Hale. Mr. Hale, are you on the line?
I am.
You can proceed. Please identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent.
Yeah, my name is Timothy Hale, H-A-L-E, and I'm representing myself. I'd like to thank the committee for taking up this subject. And second of all, I'd like to apologize because I seem to have an old version of the bill here that I'm looking at. But my main concern was, in the old version, Section 13 was the repeal of certain sections of 1738, 020, 030, 040, and 070. I would like to speak out against that. I'd like to see that I don't think that it's necessary to repeal those portions, and that it would be, I understand that they seem kind of redundant with the new provisions you're putting in, but I don't want to see those repealed. After listening to the reading of the new bill over the last hour, the other concerns I have are with the testing and the intoxication requirements for driving and for, say, pre-employment drug testing. Currently, pre-employment drug testing is at 50 nanograms per milliliter. And at that level, depending on your body weight, the THC can stay in your bloodstream anywhere from 30 to like 90 days. So is that going to remain at that level, I guess, is kind of my question. Or is it going to be more like pre-employment alcohol screening where you take a breathalyzer and if you are, you know, if you come out with any detectable amount of alcohol in your breath from the night before, then you're going to be kicked back on the job. As far as the questions on the driving, I know that there are some tests out there, one of them being like a mouth swab where they take your saliva and analyze it. And I'm not sure that they're, you know, approved by the National Highway Transportation Administration or whatever, but that is something that the legislature might look into. And again, thank you for taking the time to do this. I know you guys have a lot to do with the budget shortfall and all that. So that's pretty much all I have.
Thank you very much. The next person is Dolly Phelps from Nikiski. Dolly, can you identify yourself and tell
us? Hello, yes.
My name is Dolly Phelps. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Dolly. Please identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Okay, yes. My name is Dolinda Phelps. I'm a resident here in, Nikiski, and I'm representing myself. I've been listening to the testimony today, and many of the things have already been gone over several times by other callers. I think one of the things, and again, this is reiterated by several other people, but one of the things that is concerning is the testing, and the testing is going to be a difficult bear to tackle. I understand that. But I did read somewhere where Dr. Butler was talking about where CBDs would need to be, a level of CBD would need to be determined as well for driving violations. And it must be very highly misunderstood, but cannabidiol, CBD, has absolutely zero psychoactive effects whatsoever. It is absolutely, should not even be considered. It should be excluded. And another reason for this is, one, there's no psychoactive effects whatsoever in CBD in any amount. And a lot of medical patients have to use cannabidiol in very high concentrates to heal their physical ailments. So this should be looked at very carefully. And also the testing method, you know, the 2 to 5 nanograms, you know, if somebody uses regularly, they're obviously going to build up a little bit of a tolerance there. So 5 nanograms, that may not affect them at all, you know, and it's not fair to exclude licensed drivers in any, you know, from using a medication that helps them. So in the process that another caller was talking about, to where juicing with raw cannabis, you know, you don't get any psychoactive effects, and this is true. There's a process called decarboxylation, to where the plant material would need to be heated to above 240 degrees before THC becomes active. In its raw form, it's THC acid or CBD acid. After the decarboxylation process, it then becomes THC in its more common form, which is the part that recreational users enjoy. So, and there was another issue in the bill that I'm not sure on, and it was talking about registered, the term registered meaning what? I'm not sure about that, but it was concerning me of whether the bill was saying that, was that referring to medical users, or was that saying every recreational user needs to be registered, or, you know, that was a little bit unclear to me.
Dolly, I can just clarify it, whereas talking about registered, it's not talking about registered marijuana users, it's talking about registered facilities for testing and for sale.
Okay, great. I appreciate your clarification there, man.
Thank you.
And let's see, also I did want to say thank you all so much for your hard work, and the key here is educating yourselves so you can make a wise decisions, and I see that you are all doing that very much so, and that is greatly appreciated. So again, thank you, and that is all I have to say.
Thank you. We have probably about 6 or 7 more people who have signed up for testimony. But we have run out of time today, but nevertheless, there are other days, and so this bill will be, I'm not going to gavel out public testimony today, and when this bill is heard again on Friday, we can continue on with the public testimony. So this committee will meet again at 1 o'clock on Friday, and with that, I'm going to gavel out.